My name is Nate Mickle. You're listening to Mickles and Dimes Layer 2, where every interview is dedicated to the simple, the practical, and the underappreciated. Mark Schultz is a clinical psychologist and associate director of the Harvard Study of Adult Development, an 85-year study of individuals and families. He is also the author of The Good Life, Lessons from the World's Longest Scientific Study of Happiness. Mark earned an undergraduate degree from Amherst College and a PhD from Cal Berkeley. I hope you enjoy learning from Mark Schultz and his incredible study, because I certainly did. Mark, it's so great to connect today. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you, Nate.
Now, before we jump into the lessons you've learned from the Harvard Study of Adult Development, could you briefly describe the study and your role in it?
Sure. The study is a remarkable study. It's been going on for more than 85 years. So it started in the late 30s. Initially, it started as two studies, both with a common aim of trying to understand what leads to human flourishing, but in very different circumstances. So it's 724 original participants. Two-thirds of those participants came from the poorest neighborhoods of Boston. Most of them were from immigrant families living in tenement buildings, very crowded circumstances, real challenging childhood environments to grow up in. The remaining one-third had a much more privileged perch. They were students at Harvard University. And both of these groups were followed intensively from the start of the study, home visits, interviews, regular questionnaires. This continued throughout their entire lives, so into adulthood, and in fact, until the end of the life. Most of the original participants have since passed away. Over the course of the study, the spouses of the original participants were included, and we're now working with more than 1,300 of their children. So this is one of the longest studies, intensive studies of human experience. And from the beginning, there was an interest in trying to understand in both those kind of ends of the spectrum, how it is that people might flourish and succeed as opposed to meet challenges, which was unusual for the 30s. I think you asked me how I got involved about 20 years ago. My longtime collaborator, Bob Waldinger, was asked to take over the study. And one of the first things he did is he brought me in. Bob and I had been collaborating at that point for over 10 years. So this was a continuation of some of the work that we had done actually on other longitudinal studies for both of us.
Well, as an experimentalist, I just am amazed and so envious of such a wonderful study. You know, I do experiments, you know, cross-sectional or moments in time. Yep. And it's just amazing to be able to learn from such an incredible study. So let's jump into what, you know, if you had to think about, you know, the two or three most valuable lessons you've learned from this most incredible study, what lessons would you most want to share with others?
Yeah, so big question and one that we've given some thought to. So in the lead up to writing our book, The Good Life, Bob Waldinger and I sat down and said, is there a story that we could tell? Is there a kind of signal among the research that from this 85 years of study, you know, hundreds of papers? And we were skeptical at first. We said, well, let's see, we'll take a look. And when we stepped back and looked at all those papers, there was one variable that stood out for its robustness. And in the book, we summarize it this way. Relationships keep us happier and healthier throughout the lifespan. So that's the big message from the research. It's all kinds of relationships, and relationships serve many different functions. One of the key ones that we highlight in our book is the way that relationships help us navigate stress and challenges in our life. So when we're facing unpredictability or a big challenge or stress in our life, we often look to other people for all kinds of help figuring out a path forward, help dealing with the emotions that might be challenging for us, just support more generally that we find we need people when we're experiencing challenge. So dealing with stress is one of the big boosts that relationships give us when it comes to happiness and health. But there are other things. They help us figure out who we are. They connect us with our past. These are the places where we often experience our most joy. So when we really sat down, looked at our findings, and importantly, we also looked at other findings to see whether this was a robust set of findings or whether it was particular to this unusual study. And we in fact found that it was robust. We find that relationships help in all sorts of ways that I think are underappreciated. And they're a pretty significant predictor also of both health and happiness. So that's the marquee, that's the big picture finding, Nate. Yeah.
So such an interesting finding, something that many of us maybe know intuitively, but are prone to underappreciate, just how much relationships matter and all the different ways they can help us.
I think that's right. And one of the things I've realized as I've talked more and more about this idea is that oftentimes we need to look toward the opposite of it. So we think it's the benefits of good relationships that are important, all kinds, as I've suggested. But if we look at the absence of good relationships, if we think about people who report being lonely, these are folks that don't feel like they have anyone in their corner or anyone who really knows them well or has their back. We now know, and it's a huge public health concern, that the risk associated with loneliness for physical health outcomes is on the order of the same risk as smoking and obesity. Wow. So the absence of relationships is corrosive for our health, and that's true of all sorts of modern ailments that we experience, dementia. It's also true of mental disorders like depression. So relationships, it turns out, are really critical for flourishing, for human flourishing. They're like food. We all need them. We may need different things or have different preferences, but we all need those relationships in our life.
So that's exactly what I'm talking about, where we know they matter, but we're so prone to underappreciate just how much. So if I remember right, smoking in the United States kills about 500,000 people, more than alcohol, more than COVID. At the peak of COVID, smoking was still killing more people than COVID.
Yeah.
More than car accidents. And so this is like one of the absolute greatest risk factors for people not having great relationships.
That's right.
What have you learned about relationships and from this study during the time of COVID?
Yeah, so let me pivot to that in just a second, but I want to also emphasize that's not just the amount of risk that's important here. So officially, this is important work that's been done by Julianne Holt Lundstedt and other folks. The risk associated with loneliness is about the same as smoking 15 cigarettes a day.
Oh,
this is for premature death. The problem with loneliness is that it's also quite prevalent. It's more common than smoking these days. So in any of the recent studies that have been done, for example, in the United States, in a given week, adults report loneliness on average about 20 to 50% of the adult population is reporting it. So not only is it a serious risk factor, unfortunately, it's also quite prevalent or popular. And that's why our Surgeon General has talked about this as an important public health crisis, the crisis of disconnection. So you asked about COVID and the pandemic, and I think that was a place where certainly we all saw in sort of stark relief the importance of connections to others when we were having to do without those connections on a daily basis, without being able to see people in person. People who didn't fully appreciate how significant relationships were in their life really recognized how difficult that was. So I think, you know, important increases in anxiety, and just sort of existential worry about what the future may bring when we're not able to connect with people. The acute part of the pandemic, when we had social separation, our physical separation, that was particularly important and I think threatened our sense of connection and the kind of experience of support that we feel with others. And more generally, just the kind of uplift that we get when we're able to interact with others. For most of us, those interactions with others provide a little jolt of energy, a reminder that we're not alone on this planet here, that we have connections with people beyond even our families and people that we're close with. And I think that sense of being isolated is a kind of, we experience it as a chronic stressor. And that's part of why loneliness, again, is corrosive for our health. So I think the pandemic reminded us of that. It also pointed to both the benefits of technologies and being able to overcome physical isolation, and also some of the challenges that people didn't feel quite as connected when they were using technologies to communicate as they might have felt when they were in person with other people.
Yeah, so you mentioned technology. What effects are you seeing from social media?
So I think, you know, there are a few effects. The big one that lots of folks are talking about are the social comparison effects. So we're, as human beings, we're quite prone to comparing our lot to others. This has been true for a long time. When I grew up, the kind of saying that people would use is that you always compare yourself to the Joneses, the people that might live down the street. That involved getting outside of your house and looking to see whether the Joneses had a better car than your family had, or their house looked prettier than your house did. Now we can sit on our computers and our phones and look at people all around the world and make these social comparisons. And most people come out of those comparisons feeling less than they were before. They feel like they're missing out on these incredible events that people are curating online, and that they don't have things that it seems like everyone else must have. So the social comparison effects are, again, pernicious, particularly for young people and particularly for young women, it looks like, adolescent girls in particular. I think there's beginning to be research. We've done some of this ourselves, trying to look at what happens when we interact via technologies. And it's interesting, and some of it's not super surprising. The emotions are blunted when we interact via technology. And some people say that's great. You know, I hate when things get too emotional. But it turns out that emotions are part of what, you know, kind of glues us to each other. We also miss out on some of that body language that's important, particularly the whole body language. So on Zoom, you can see people's face and their upper torso, but you lose a sense of their whole body. And that rhythm that we have when we talk to people isn't accessible. So people often report feeling less close and less connected to parties when they talk online. I think it's going to change. The technologies will get better, and we're going to learn how to take advantage of them. But what it means is that the experience via technology, that communication experience is not the same. It's often less than in-person experiences. And then there are other pieces which are more procedural, but we forget about them. When we go to meetings, for example, at universities, or we have classes that are in person, there's time before class, there's time after class, there's time as we walk down the hall that we see each other. And when we do things completely online, a lot of that informal connecting time is missing. I think that's fixable, right? Their way is probably to recreate that time. But this focus on online communication being efficient, right? We don't have to commute. We don't even have to get dressed up in our fancy outfits. It's a focus on efficiency, and what we may be losing is some connection, I think, Nate.
Okay, so last question. Does your research shed light on how people can build relationships?
Yeah. So we talk a lot in The Good Life about this idea that we call social fitness. So just like our physical fitness, where we intentionally lean in and try and do something about how we're able to navigate in the physical world, we can do the same with our social connections. So it starts with really stepping back, reflecting on what's working in your relationship world. So what relationships are good for you, what relationships are bringing you joy and that sense of energy that I talked about. What relationships are more challenging, and thinking about what it is that may be challenging about those relationships. And then it's a kind of commitment to leaning in and being proactive. So we, as our participants were much older in life, in their 80s, we asked them to reflect back on their lives and to share with us whether they had any regrets. And most of the regrets had to do with relationships. I wish I had not lost contact with important friends. I wish I had been kinder to people in my life, my wife, my husband, my kids, people I worked with. The regrets mostly focused around relationships that hadn't been sufficiently nourished and cultivated across that lifespan. And what we found is that relationships wither if they don't get that intention and attention that's required. So this notion of social fitness is a metaphor that people can use to lean in and kind of be much more intentional about their connections with others. It means making time for it. It also means when you make the time, for example, time to have lunch with a friend or to go for a walk with someone that you care about, you want to be really present and interested in what they have to say. So social fitness is about, you know, prioritizing relationships, making time for them, and really being present and curious when you're with other people.
Well, I love that phrase of social fitness. It reminds me of a quote I heard once from John Wooden. He advised people to treat friendship like a fine art.
Mm.
And implicit in that, of course, is that, you know, you're thinking about it, you're caring for it. And so this idea of social fitness, yeah, we know we need to exercise. We know we need to, you know, resistance train or, you know, cardio train. But I love this idea of thinking about our social relationships in terms of keeping them fit as well. Yeah. Well, Mark, as you know, the theme of this podcast is simple, practical, and underappreciated. And so I just love hearing these lessons from you on something that is so easy to underappreciate, but your findings are simple, they are practical, and just perfect fit for this podcast. So I just want to thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Yeah, such a pleasure. Good to talk with you, Nate. I enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Mickles and Dimes. What great findings Mark shared from the Harvard Study of Adult Development that he's now the director of, one of the longest studies on human experience ever conducted. The study has followed more than 2,000 people spanning more than 85 years, and the one finding that stands out above all other findings is that relationships keep us happier and healthier through our lives. Yet sadly, loneliness is quite prevalent. In the United States, in a given week, 20 to 50% of adults report being lonely, and loneliness is as damaging to health as smoking 15 cigarettes per day. To reduce loneliness, people can focus on social fitness. Just as physical fitness is an important predictor of health and happiness, so too is social fitness. By thinking about our social lives in terms of what's working and then prioritizing our positive social relationships, we can improve our happiness. Social fitness is all about making time for our friends and loved ones as well, eating lunch with them, going on walks with them, or calling them. When people in their 80s discuss their regrets, most regrets are centered on relationships, losing contact with friends, or not being as kind as they could have been to the people they loved. In summary, to be happier and healthier, and to avoid regrets later in life, prioritize social fitness. It's a simple idea. Please take it seriously. Nate Mickle here with a couple requests. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the podcast and leave a 5-star review on your podcast player. Lastly, if you're like me and want to remember all of the lessons shared in previous episodes, visit the list of lessons page on my website, natemickle.com, to see all of the lessons that each previous guest has shared. Thanks for your support.